The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Crime, justice, impact.
Are you making this up?
No.
Stories that change lives.
I take no pleasure having to interview with 48 Hours about this.
Get a clue. 48 Hours, Saturdays on CBS.
From the Capital One Bank studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The war of words in Washington.
This president is obstructing justice, and he's engaged in a cover-up.
I'm an extremely stable genius.
Student loan debt is strangling Americans.
You want to put a little bit more extra money down on those loans, if you can.
States are slowly chipping away at Roe versus Wade.
There are some people who believe that Roe versus Wade is a shaky opinion. I don't happen to be one of those people.
I'm Bill Rakoff in the CBS News Washington Bureau. Well, this week came to an end with a flurry of insults and accusations from one end of Pennsylvania Avenue to the other, as President Trump said he would not work with congressional Democrats until they wrap up their investigations of him. The president was set off by remarks this week by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The president's behavior in terms of his obstruction of justice, the things that he is doing, is very clear. It's in plain sight. Ignoring subpoenas, obstruction of justice. Yes, these could be impeachable offenses.
But the president fired back, saying Democratic accusations all stem from sour grapes from 2016.
The whole Democrat Party is very messed up. They have never recovered from the great election of 2016, an election that I think you folks liked very much, right? Well, Nancy Pelosi was not happy about it, and she is a mess.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy is here. Never a dull moment these days at the White House, particularly as we look at the relationships going on between the administration and Capitol Hill. And they really were brought to the forefront this week with this very, very public spat between the president and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Things seemed to hit a new low, Bill, on Thursday when the president called the House Speaker a mess, saying she has lost it. That after Nancy Pelosi accused the president of engaging in a cover-up. By late Thursday into Friday morning, there were these videos going around the internet that seemed to show Nancy Pelosi stammering over her words, and some of the videos were deliberately altered to make it seem like she was speaking slower than she was normally. By the end of it, you had the president of the United States saying that he had a calm demeanor at his meeting with Democrats on Wednesday. It was a response to Nancy Pelosi describing it as a temper tantrum.
Well, what was interesting to me was that he paraded a series of officials from his cabinet in front of the mics on Thursday to talk a little bit about that. And they all backed him up. And I thought it was kind of funny because Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, said, well, I've seen both sides. And so she said he was calm. So it was an interesting comment for her to make. But nonetheless, it was just very strange to have the president seemingly important to defend his approach. Nevertheless, what was said, but the way he said it.
Well, in and of itself, it seemed a response to Nancy Pelosi's call to have an intervention within the White House, either amongst the president's staffers or his family members, to try to convince the president to change his ways and get back to the negotiating table. Instead, what the president did was he had his aides attest to his very calm demeanor. And one after another, people who are close to the president told reporters that he was very calm.
Stephen Portnoy is with us from the White House as we discuss this blow up between the administration and Capitol Hill. The president brought Democratic leaders to the White House earlier this week. Ostensibly, they were going to talk about infrastructure. But as you mentioned, right an hour before going to the White House, Nancy Pelosi, who is very, deliberate in the things that she says, chose that time to say that she thought that the president was engaged in a cover-up. An hour later, the president comes out and essentially says, I'm not going to work with you as long as you guys are throwing these accusations around and doing these investigations. Do the investigations, get them out of the way, and then we'll talk. He says you can't do both. But of course, Stephen, there's plenty of precedent for administrations and Congress being able to do both.
Oh, I mean, you could look at what happened in the early 1970s as the House and Senate were digging into Watergate. Nixon got plenty done with the Congress. But Donald Trump says that these Democrats can choose either to be on the investigation track or what he called the investment track. And what it calls into question is whether anything can get done now here in Washington. The president wants the Democratic-controlled House to pass this USMCA trade agreement with Canada and Mexico that he just negotiated. Now the president says there won't be any negotiations on anything. So he sort of wants to have it both ways. He expects that the Democrats will do what he wants them to do, but he won't negotiate on the terms. By the fall, if this dynamic continues, you could see the possibility of a government shutdown and maybe even a default on the debt, because the debt ceiling will once again become an issue in the fall. But the aides to the president say, no, 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 that's not going to happen. We expect Democrats, they'll say, to do what the country expects them to do. Democrats, on the other hand, expect that this president will meet their demands for information and testimony. And that's why you had Nancy Pelosi say on Thursday that the president and his aides seem to be crying out for impeachment by issuing blanket denials and refusals to their demands and subpoenas.
Well, let's talk about that for just a little bit, because Pelosi, she knows how to operate within her caucus, and as she's proving here, being able to play deftly with the president. But she is under extreme pressure from some members of her caucus and from Democratic presidential candidates on the trail to begin the impeachment inquiry. She has been very reluctant to go down that road, perhaps because she remembers what happened to Republicans during the Bill Clinton impeachment. They lost a lot of popularity, and with the 2020 election coming up, it has to weigh heavily on her mind.
Well, there's no question. And the president said on Thursday, I don't think people are going to stand for a House impeachment inquiry. I think that Nancy Pelosi is worried that it would just embolden the president's supporters to come out for him in 2020. Plus, once the debates start on the Democratic side, the Democratic candidates are going to be offering their own vision for the future and perhaps, talking about impeachment in Washington, D.C. could be a distraction from that and perhaps work against the Democrats. That said, there are many in the House Democratic Caucus who believe that by initiating an impeachment inquiry, they will have a stronger hand, if nothing else, in court in demanding documents and testimony, because an impeachment inquiry has been viewed under past court rulings as something of a judicial proceeding that is due even more deference than your typical congressional investigation.
And Pelosi acknowledging the reality of the situation. At first, she just did not want to go down that road. This week, she's saying things to the effect of, well, let's let the investigative process do its job. We may get to a point where the evidence is there that we need to do an impeachment inquiry. And then she said, or not.
Well, and I think she's trying to hedge at this point because she doesn't know what could come next. She doesn't want to flatly rule anything out, but she's also not picking up and taking up the charge the way some of her colleagues would like her to.
CBS News' Stephen Portnoy at the White House. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Still to come, tackling student loan debt. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Nearly 2 million Americans are going to graduate college this year with a bachelor's degree, but each student will also be carrying an average student loan debt of more than $33,000. CBS News business analyst Joel Schlesinger on CBS This Morning says it's dangerous for parents to dip into their own funds to help their kids pay down debt, and she also has some tips on what college grads and their families need to do to prioritize.
I think the first thing you have to do is start tracking your money. So encourage your kids to get one of these apps, and there are lots of free ones. There are free ones from banks. There's Mint.com. There's Clarity Money. Find out what's coming in, what's going out. Now, you're going to build in that student loan debt. Yeah. And you really want to try to figure out how many loans do you have outstanding? What is actually the interest rate of each of those loans? And while those companies are going to give you the minimum that's due, you want to pay more than the minimum. The only way you can figure out how much more is to track that money going in and out.
So these students who have debt, on average, if they have it, they're paying about $400 a month on those loans. You tell people to save, but they also have the loans. How do they deal with the loans and save at the same time? What do they do first?
Welcome to adulthood, where we have multiple priorities.
Let's talk about camera.
It's very
I've
sad.
I've been struggling with it my whole
exactly.
life.
Exactly. It's very. So I always have talked about something called the big three. And what are the big three? It's paying down debt, it's having an emergency reserve fund, and it's starting that great habit of retirement savings. The problem is that one is not necessarily more important than the other. We sort of have yes to all of them. If you've got large outstanding student loans, you want to put a little bit more extra money down on those loans if you can. But on the other hand, if you've got a company that has a matching component to your retirement plan, you want to at least put a little bit of money there. So a little bit of everything. But only those three things are the things that new grads need to concentrate on.
Well, the numbers show that a lot of kids are going to their parents for
That's
help.
That's the emergency fund.
Yeah, it's a pretty good emergency fund, too. 7 out of 10 have gone to their parents for help. A lot of adults are dipping into their retirement funds to help their kids. Good idea, bad idea?
I'm really worried about a lot of parents. Now, look, if you are an extremely fortunate family and your parents can help you out, okay, that may work. But for so many families, parents are shortchanging their own retirement. And this is dangerous. And the reason is that when your kids have these loans and they're paying off their loans, that's fine. If later on you can help them after you've got a secure retirement, that's one thing. But if you cannot retire with great security, you're going to have to turn to your kids to help bail you out.
Yeah.
And as you said to me in the green room, I hope they're there for you.
Yeah, I hope it's not. You helped mom last time. Now it's your I did it last time. Now it's your turn.
Now it's your turn.
But I don't know as an adult parent how you don't help your kids.
That's you're going to do it. I want to say this. You want to assist and guide, but not to enable.
That's CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger with Gail King, Anthony Mason, and Tony DeCopole of CBS This Morning. Well, speaking of assists, how about the big assist that graduating Morehouse College seniors received this week from their commencement speaker? Here's CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman.
This is my class, 2019.
At Morehouse College, billionaire investor Robert Smith's commencement speech included a congratulations card stuffed with cash.
We're going to put a little fuel in your bus. My family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Smith will pay off the student debts of almost 400 graduating seniors.
Did you know it was coming?
I had no idea.
Morehouse president David Thomas.
People were stunned. If you look at any other film footage, you'll see the students turning to each other. Like, what did he say? What did he say?
And like mid-graduation is just a text from my mom. Like, is this, you serious? I'm like, he's serious.
Graduate Dwight Lewis is from Compton, California, where as a kid, he was homeless. The 21-year-old business major danced across the stage. Gone were $150,000 in student loans.
I never imagined that I would essentially get a full ride for college in my last 30 seconds of being an undergrad student.
Morehouse told us its students typically graduate owing $28,000 in student loans, on par with other historically black schools, and about $7,100 more than student borrowers from other colleges and universities. No wonder Smith heard the crowd chant MVP, Most Valuable Philanthropist.
This will allow them to pursue their dreams.
As opposed to just servicing the debt.
In return, Smith asked his recipients to pay it forward.
I'm so motivated to go change the world, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
CBS's Mark Strassman reporting. Meanwhile, a proposed tax incentive for businesses could bring relief for more than 44 million Americans saddled with student debt. CBS's Ed O'Keefe is on Capitol Hill.
The idea is to allow companies to provide tax-free student loan relief to workers that are paying off student loan debt. It's supported by hundreds of Democrats and Republicans up here, but like most things, it's being held up by politics. That means that recent college grads looking for help and the companies willing to provide relief are going to have to wait a little longer. 24-year-old Juan Navarro works in the corporate offices of Fairway, a chain of grocery stores based in Iowa. He has more than $19,000 left to pay on his student loans.
Didn't really grasp until my junior year of college when I said, wow, I'm going to be graduating next year and I'm going to have all this debt.
Navarro is paying down his debt with the help of Fairway. The company is giving him roughly $5,000 to help erase his student loans.
With this benefit now, I'm able to save money on interest and also to get rid of my student loan debt quicker.
But the benefit is taxed, so Fairway and Navarro are waiting for Congress to sweeten the deal.
Currently, a company can contribute up to $5,250 tax-free each year for tuition assistance, helping workers who are attending classes while on the job. But no such tax break exists to help workers who are paying off student loans on degrees they've already earned. A bill working its way through Congress would let companies do just that. Neither the company nor the employee would pay any tax on the money. So far, companies like Starbucks, Verizon, and Hewlett-Packard support the legislation. The athletic company New Balance said in a statement that if the bill passes, the company will introduce a student loan repayment benefit. All we are waiting for is federal legislation.
This gives a win for the student and a win for the employer.
Democratic Senator Mark Warner and Republican John Thune are lead sponsors of the bill that would provide the tax break.
So many students who go to our best colleges and universities work really hard to get a degree, and then they come out and trade in their cap and gown for a mountain of debt and uncertainty.
The idea is backed by more than two dozen other senators and more than 140 members of the House. But in the Senate, it'll need to pass as part of a larger tax bill that's yet to be introduced. Some critics warn that while popular, the incentive would encourage more borrowing and higher education costs. Navarro says the repayment benefit he's already receiving has changed his life.
I'm a little less stressed, a little more excited for my future, what can hold as far as I will be out of debt sooner.
We got word that this legislation has support from Ivanka Trump, someone known to have a little sway with her father. She said in a statement to CBS News that she and her team believe this legislation will have a transformative effect on students entering the workforce as well as workers seeking to advance their careers.
That's CBS's Ed O'Keefe. Still to come, chipping away at Roe versus Wade. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The biggest names in politics.
We begin today with President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, Ambassador Nikki Haley, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Face the questions you want answered.
Are you going to challenge the president in 2020?
Face the nation, Sundays on CBS.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. The growing campaign to limit a woman's right to an abortion is getting pushback across the nation. Abortion rights activists held hundreds of rallies this week to protest moves by at least eight states to approve wide-ranging restrictions on abortion. Among them, the state of Alabama, which last week banned virtually all abortions, even in cases of rape. The efforts to chip away at Roe v. Wade come as new polling highlights its support, with two out of three Americans telling CBS News they don't want to see the ruling overturned. Here's CBS's Jan Crawford.
Abortion rights supporters organized rallies in all 50 states. All in support of Roe versus Wade.
We deserve autonomy for our body in this country.
The coordinated effort brought Democratic presidential contenders to the Supreme Court to protest recent state anti-abortion laws. But most of the legal fight will be outside of Washington and in the lower courts, including in Mississippi, where a federal judge there indicated Tuesday he's likely to block a law that would ban most abortions once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Before the Supreme Court decided in 1973 that abortion was a protected right under the Constitution, the issue was up to the individual states. And Americans still are generally in favor of Roe, but opposition hasn't softened. A new CBS News poll found two-thirds of Americans want the Supreme Court to keep Roe versus Wade as it is, while 28% want it overturned. In 1975, 54% said they supported abortion under certain circumstances, and 22% said it should be illegal.
Now, the chances that any of these cases will actually make it to the Supreme Court are pretty slim. I mean, these laws, they're just so at odds with Supreme Court precedent that the lower courts are going to strike them down, and the justices are really unlikely to jump in at that point. But there are more incremental cases in the pipeline. Those put some restrictions on abortion, but they are way short of any kind of ban.
At CBS's Jan Crawford, CBS News's Julia Weaver sat down this week to discuss the issue with CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleeman.
Ricky, I want to start by asking you to explain the basis of Roe versus Wade. I think some people might not realize that it's based on an individual's right to privacy. Talk a little bit about that and why some constitutional scholars believe the opinion is shaky.
There are some people who believe that Roe versus Wade is a shaky opinion. I don't happen to be one of those people. But for constitutional law scholars who think it is shaky, it is because it is based on a so-called constitutional right to privacy. Of course, if you read the Constitution, there is no such thing called the right to privacy. The reason I don't think it is shaky is because it is based on precedent. It is based on another case called Griswold versus Connecticut, which was decided back in 1965, that created this right to privacy under the 14th Amendment as part of due process. So by the time you get to Roe in 1973, it becomes a natural extension to say that a woman has the right to her own privacy about her reproductive health.
Ricky, part of the reason we're talking today is because there's this growing movement to take down Roe versus Wade. I'm wondering, if one of these cases gets kicked all the way up to the Supreme Court, how would those arguing the case go about trying to take down Roe versus Wade? What might they do to chip away at it?
The movement to take down Roe versus Wade is very well organized, both for short-term tactics and long-term strategy. And what people are doing is they are both getting state legislatures to enact laws that go as far as Alabama, which is to say that they're is no such thing, really, as Roe versus Wade, in that you would have no abortion except if the woman's life was in danger. Or states have gone to the fetal heartbeat laws. The people who are looking to overturn Roe are looking to get cases based on these laws, to have those cases go up one by one, and they will ultimately chip away at Roe on the basis of little restrictions, not these broad-based laws that are clearly unconstitutional.
I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little more on those types of restrictions. What things are we seeing that might make it more difficult for a woman to get an abortion?
When you have restrictions like we have seen in certain laws, which mean that a doctor must have privileges at a hospital, that the hospital must be within 30 miles of where that doctor does the abortion, that those types of restrictions having to do with time, having to do with place, are the types of restrictions that may be seen by a court as not creating a substantial burden about Roe. Other courts would differ. But if the United States Supreme Court starts to pick away at those types of restrictions one by one and diluting Roe in years to come, I don't mean this year or next year, but at some point, if it's chipped away enough that Roe could be overturned without it being as big a deal as it would be today, at least in terms of the law. So, what are the states doing? The states around the country are doing two polar opposite things. You have some states that are making law that really is trying to diminish or take away Roe. And you have other states which are expanding Roe so that there will be a right for a woman to control her reproductive health whether or not Roe is overturned.
I'd like to talk a little more about that sort of push-pull agenda, because we have these dueling legislative efforts, but Roe is settled law. So I'm wondering what state legislatures can actually do to really bolster or undermine Roe versus Wade. How might that actually play out in the Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court should be bound by precedent. That's the way the law works. You are not supposed to overturn settled law. This is settled law since 1973. However, we have to remember how Roe got decided in the first place. And a lot of that had to do with the women's movement, as well as with the advocacy of gynecologists who saw botched abortions at that time when women were dying at the rate of about 17%. That's 17 per 100 women. What people who are against Roe are trying to do is to have a public outcry that looks to the other side and looks to fetal health, that is the fetal heartbeat bills, the question of viability. When is a fetus viable? That's a question in Roe. So you have those laws on one side. On the other side, you have the pro-Roe people who are trying to pass laws which would allow abortion up to and through the time of birth. Those are opposite extremes. How does that ultimately affect the court? The court should still be looking back at Roe. That's its precedent.
That was CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleeman, and I am Julia Weaver for CBS News Radio.
You can follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Bill Rakoff. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff, and we're joined by CBS News Face the Nation moderator and senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan. The president announced on Friday, after a lot of talk, that some 1,500 troops are going to go to the Middle East. This is an apparent response to what the administration is terming as increased rhetoric, aggression, if you will, by Iran. It's a little bit short of the 2,000 troops that we'd been hearing earlier in the week, but it's still a pretty good number.
It is. I mean, 1,500 plus some Patriot missile battalions, some surveillance aircraft as well. This is to, as you say, deter and counter the perceived threat from Iran. There was that intelligence over the past few weeks that showed Shiite militias in Iraq were preparing to attack U.S. forces in Iraq. That, along with some other items, had caused the U.S. threat level to go up and U.S. personnel at some of our diplomatic posts to be pulled out. But now this building up militarily is meant to deter. But this is far from the kind of level of force you would need for an invasion. This is not where we were during the Iraq war by any means. But this is a bit of muscle flexing.
And it's interesting because, you know, there's been varying level of signals about this, depending who you talk to in the administration. Right. I mean, you have John Bolton saying one thing, and then you've got Shanahan and others later on this week saying, well, you know, the big threat that we thought was, well, maybe it's scaled back a little bit. And then you've got the president saying something completely different. So where are we?
Well, this was a sharp reaction when the intelligence was detected, with CENTCOM asking the White House to issue that statement you heard from John Bolton weeks ago that really got attention because it was so clear the Trump administration was taking this threat very seriously. But then the president's own instincts seemed to overpower that of his national security advisors in that he campaigned on not getting involved in foreign wars. Remember, it was only in February when he said he was bringing 2,000 troops home from Syria because he didn't even want that small number, relatively small number, still in the Middle East. Now, that's been slowed down. That number has been reduced. But it shows you where the president's actual instincts are, and it is not to get involved. That is very different from the worldview of John Bolton, the national security advisor, who really believes in a more hawkish approach.
But you made just a great point here a minute ago. That request came from CENTCOM. So for those who are trying to make this a political thing, that actually came from officials on the ground there. And we should pay attention to that.
We should. You know, this is one of the things I think that's troubling. We're in this environment now where we doubt our institutions, and at a moment of crisis, that could be a really dangerous thing. It was CENTCOM who asked the White House to put out that message, and it was intelligence gathered on the ground that led to this threat being perceived. Now, this is something that there was a lot of political rhetoric around and scrutiny because of the past history with 2003 and the Iraq War invasion and the lack of precision in some of the language that the president has used and others in describing what's happening leading up to this point. The other sort of level of complication here is, why did the threat become acute? Is it because of some of the things the administration has policy-wise decided to do, such as designating the Revolutionary Guard of Iran as a terrorist organization? They, in turn, then labeled CENTCOM a terrorist organization. And there you have it. So that's where the argument goes from intelligence to policy and politics really quickly.
CBS News Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan, also our senior foreign affairs correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley is out with a book that chronicles his career entitled Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. He spoke with our Steve Dorsey.
Scott, there's a pivotal event in your book, the 2015 bombings in Paris. What kind of impact did that have on you?
Oh, Steve, that's the way the book opens, because it was in that moment that I really got a critical mass of understanding about something that I had been seeing for decades. As you recall, in Paris at that time, about 120 civilians were killed by ISIS in a terrorist attack. And I was watching Parisians, men, women, and children, bringing candles to a makeshift memorial in the street. And I saw on their faces this look of bewilderment, and I thought, I have seen these people before. I saw them at the World Trade Center on 9/11. I saw them in Oklahoma City. People wondering essentially, what is the meaning of life? And it occurred to me in that moment that maybe we're asking the wrong question. Don't ask the meaning of life. Life is asking, what's the meaning of you? And that led me to write this book about the amazing people that I have met around the world in war and in peace who have discovered the answer to that question.
And what's your meaning, Scott?
Oh, boy, what a great question. I think the meaning of my life right now is to be a stepping stone for the next generation of journalists. The last chapter in the book is called To a Young Journalist, and in it I explain our values. There is no democracy without journalism. Madison wrote that freedom of the press is the right that guarantees all the others. The stakes are that high, and I want the next generation of journalists to be there for us because the quality of our democracy depends almost entirely on the quality of our journalism, because our citizens have to have clear, accurate, unbiased information to make decisions about their country.
But listen, Scott, as you know, we can do quality journalism. You can do quality journalism. But it's up to folks to decide where to get their news. How do you, or should we, as a society, as a culture in this country, steer people towards certain news outlets or certain styles of reporting?
The audience, radio, podcasts, internet, television, the audience has to take responsibility themselves for finding the right information. When you hear something that outrages you or you wonder about whether it could be true, don't take that and whisper it to your neighbor. Take that and look and ask yourself, what are the really reputable organizations reporting about this? You may find more often than not that they're not reporting about it because the darn thing didn't happen. But it's so important that people educate themselves. The brand name news organizations, the people who are working there have been trained in journalism. They're being supervised by people who've been in journalism for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And there are enormous costs to their reputation if they get something wrong. So instead of looking at some website you've never heard of and being outraged by a story that you haven't read anywhere else, I say go to the brand name organizations that you can trust to make sure you're getting a variety of news.
CBS's Scott Pelley talking about his book, Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning and the Stories of Our Times. You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
This week, Tony Schwartz, co-author of Donald Trump's seminal autobiography, Art of the Deal.
Do you regret the book?
Greatest regret of my life, without question. I've spent 2.5 years out there trying to warn people about who this man is. Sociopath or psychopath.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Season 2 of CBS's Whistleblower debuts with the story of a former Chicago police officer who risked not just her career but her life to expose a massive criminal ring in her own department. And joining us to talk about it is Whistleblower host Alex Ferrer. Alex, thanks for joining us. A blockbuster to open up your second season.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Bill. It's an incredible story. Shannon Spaulding, the officer, is an incredible person as well. I think you're going to really enjoy the show.
So tell me a little bit about this. I mean, whistleblowers inside a police department, nothing necessarily new, but, you know, sometimes there's the pressure. There's the thin blue line sometimes we've heard about, usually used in most honorable terms. But sometimes in instances, there are cases of police corruption. And tell me a little bit about Officer Spaulding and how she came to the point where she felt like she needed to do something, in essence, to be the whistleblower.
Yeah, first of all, you're totally right about that. I'm a former police officer myself, and when officers refer to the thin blue line, I would say almost uniformly across the country, they're referring to the fact that they are a thin border between the decent law-abiding citizens and evil. But there are some departments that have taken that thin blue line corrupted the term to say basically you don't cross that thin blue line. You don't go and report problems in the police department outside of the police department. And in some departments, and that's what it was like in Chicago, and I hope it has changed. I don't know that it has. That has consequences. When a police officer reports something that another police officer is doing that is criminal or wrong, of course it shouldn't. Shannon Spaulding was a great police officer. Her and her partner worked well together. It was her lifelong dream to be a police officer. She enjoyed it. And during the course of her work, she came to find out that there was a particular officer who had actually trained her and his group. He had a team, and they were basically criminals with badges. That is what they were. They were. She was working in the projects in the high crime area, and started finding out that this officer was and his team. They were basically running the drug trade. They were dealing in drugs. They were shaking people down for money. If the people didn't have money to give them, they'd plant drugs on them and send them to prison. It's just a horrible thing. I mean, can you imagine the law-abiding citizens who have to live in the projects because they don't have a way out are terrified of the drug dealers that are around them and the criminals around them. And then on top of that, they have to be terrified of the police officers. So she comes forward and she blows the whistle, which is, a difficult thing to do on your fellow officers, but totally warranted when an officer is doing this. You know, I mean, who wouldn't? Right. Well, it just her whole life just came crashing down upon her. I mean, when you watch tonight's episode, the roller coaster of emotions that she and her partner and the people who were subjected to these false arrests had to live with. It's an amazing story. It cost her dearly. Her life was threatened. Attempts were made on her life. She lost her career. But there's such a silver lining to this story. I mean, there are. So far, more than 60 people, and we don't even know where it's going to end, more than 60 people who have been exonerated, who were falsely arrested and sent to prison by these police officers, all because she was willing to sacrifice everything she had to do the right thing. So it's a powerful story. It's riveting, and I think you're really going to like it.
Whistleblower now in its second season. What have you learned through the process of the first season in terms of doing this? I'm sure as a former police officer, and you don't just focus on law enforcement, but I'm sure your eyes were wide open to certain things. But did you learn anything in particular going through season one?
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, I was a police officer, and then I was a judge in Miami with the fourth largest court system in the U.S. I pretty much thought I'd seen everything. But I'm amazed at the character of whistleblowers. These are just special kinds of people. Everyone I've met so far came forward and blew the whistle because it was the right thing to do. And you ask them why, and generally the response I get repeatedly is that's the way I was raised. You know, that you don't do this. And they uniformly lose their careers. They are blackballed. I've had so many of them who lose their homes, lose their marriages because of the company or the employer coming after them with everything they have. Gratefully, I think there is a law that a lot of people aren't aware of, and these whistleblowers weren't aware of when they come forward, that allows the government to share what they recover as a result of the whistleblower's actions with the whistleblower. It's a story. There are stories that are emotional. They tug at your heartstrings, and they very often have a very happy ending. But what I have learned is that these are special people, and they sacrifice everything that they have because they don't want to sit back and watch somebody just scheme and defraud us.
Giving hope to the human condition. Whistleblower airs Friday nights on CBS. You can also see the episodes online, cbs.com/shows/whistleblowers. Whistleblower host Alex Ferrer, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Bill.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This week, the man known as the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, was released from prison after serving 17 years in a federal lockup. We get more from CBS News Justice Correspondent Jeff Pegues.
A man believed to be John Walker Lynn got into a car and left a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. 18 years ago, U.S. troops captured Lynn fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. CIA officer Johnny Mike Spann interrogated Lynn. Soon after this video was recorded, Spann was killed in a prison uprising. Spann's daughter, Allison, believes Lynn remains a threat.
We still feel that he is radicalized and that releasing him into our public is a danger to everybody.
Whatever President Trump said this, there was nothing legally he could do.
What bothers me more than anything else is that here's a man who has not given up his proclamation of terror. And we have to let him out.
According to the group New America, since 9/11, 346 people have been charged and convicted in the U.S. of jihadist terrorism-related crimes. Like Lynn, 19 of them will be released this year and next.
This is the start of a wave.
Counterterrorism analyst Seamus Hughes says there is currently no strategy in place to help terrorism prisoners re-enter society.
No system.
No systematic way to address it. In many ways, we arrested our way out of this and then didn't think about the consequences at the end. And you see in the Lynn case a scramble to try to figure this out.
Law enforcement is well aware of the potential threat. A senior FBI counterterrorism official said, "We track them and the threat as they come out."
But there are limits to what the FBI can do to track former terrorism inmates. At some point, they will need a court approval because that type of surveillance cannot continue indefinitely.
That's CBS's Jeff Begays, and that's it for the Weekend Roundup. Send us your thoughts to Weekend Roundup at CBSNews.com and find the program online at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Have a terrific and safe holiday weekend. I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.